From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we look at food insecurity in Wisconsin and the increase of people turning to food banks and the state's food share program. Then, although our federal government was set up with checks and balances, they're not functioning the way the founders had hoped.
I think what they didn't possibly imagine was that you would have mass political parties with a lot of participation in those, sort of stretching across different levels of government.
Plus, we learn about the first LGBT uprising in Wisconsin, which happened 8 years before the Stonewall Riot in Greenwich Village.
The Black Night Brawl is the birthplace of LGBT pride in Milwaukee, because before that, people were laying down and taking the abuse.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The COVID-19 pandemic plunged the world's economy into the biggest recession since the Great Depression. Many Americans continue to struggle as flare-ups threaten the little progress we've been able to make since lockdowns began last April. Wisconsin is currently one of the nation's hotspots of infections, with more new cases of COVID-19 recorded here last week than all of Germany. As many people here are struggling, Wisconsinites are increasingly turning to food share benefits to keep themselves fed. A recent report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum found that participation in food share, sometimes called food stamps, has substantially increased during this pandemic. Mark Sommerhauser is a researcher with the forum, and he joins me to talk about this report. Mark, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
It's great to be with you, Joy.
So what does food share participation generally look like in the state of Wisconsin?
Yeah, so just to give a quick sort of overview, food share is the state program that's run by the Department of Health Services to distribute the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits, or SNAP benefits. And these are essentially just the benefits that previously had been called food stamps. They enable, individuals that meet income criteria and other criteria for the program to be able to buy food and other nutritional necessities that they might want to buy. And that is kind of the quick overview of how that program works.
So how many people are generally in the food share program? And I'd specifically like to look at what's changed over the last decade, because there were some major changes in eligibility.
Yes, correct. And we can get to those in a second. I'll answer your first question there first. So as of August of this year, the most recent month for which we have data, the food share program here in the state of Wisconsin counted a little over 720,000 recipients, about 724,000 recipients. And I should say as well, the number of households in the program was about 378,000 at that time. That was an increase over earlier in the year, as we explain in our report. There was a pretty sharp increase that occurred starting in the month of April of this year. And then we saw it sort of went down a little bit after that, but then went back up again in the month of August. And overall, looking at, for instance, comparing August of this year to August of last year, kind of a good way to get a sense of what the increase has been. Enrollment in the program was up about 115,000 recipients from August of 2019 to August of 2020.
So it's a big increase from last year, but as we just alluded to, there were some major changes to the program, which caused numbers to sharply decline over the last decade, while need maybe didn't decline quite as much. So maybe we should dig into this first. What are some of these newer eligibility requirements that impact the use of food share?
Yes. And just to kind of set the stage for this, there had been, kind of looking back over the last decade, there was an increase in the usage of food share, of course, during the Great Recession and the immediate wake of the Great Recession, as one would expect during and immediately after an economic downturn. Then we had a period starting around 2013 where we saw declining food share recipients. And, you know, our conclusion is that that was due to two things primarily. The first being the improving economy, but the second, which of course is an important factor, but the second piece being a series of changes in state law from about the period from 2013 to 2017 that did begin to place new limitations on who was eligible for the program. Some of kind of the most significant elements that were enacted during that period of time were various restrictions that were put in place on assets, what sorts of, whether it's real estate or other types of assets that a person could own. There was restrictions placed on that in order for somebody to qualify for food share, as well as for certain people to be eligible, they had to meet work requirements. And there were actually additional restrictions that were passed during this period as well, but that have not yet gone into effect for various reasons. Things like drug testing requirements, reinstating a requirement that people be current on their child support. These were laws that were actually enacted by the legislature but have not gone into effect. But again, the asset limits and the work requirements are two of the big ones that are in place right now. And we do believe that, you know, they have had certainly an impact along with, you know, the improving economic conditions from 2013 up until March of this year that did cause fewer numbers of people to be recipients of food share.
You know, so we have some pretty restrictive requirements for eligibility. But right now, it seems like some of those have been put to rest, at least temporarily. What does that look like right now during the pandemic? What does eligibility look like?
That is right. So there was a temporary measure that was put in place that did waive some of these restrictions. So basically, to kind of break it down here, typically pre-pandemic, able-bodied adults between the ages of 18 and 49 who were childless, who did not have children, would only qualify for 3 months of benefits out of every 3 years, period, unless they were working or in a work training program for 20 more hours a week. Now, what I think you're referring to is the federal exemption that was put in place that waived basically all work or work training requirements for able-bodied adults. This was put into place shortly after the onset of the pandemic in April, and that runs through September. Now, a second exemption period has been approved, and it looks like that's going to be taking effect actually this month now and running through September of 2021. So it does look like at least with that exemption period, that's going to carry forward for another year. So that is definitely significant. And we certainly think that could be part of what's contributing to the increase in enrollment. Although, obviously, we think probably the biggest contributor right now is just that there's quite a few more individuals, unfortunately, that have lost their employment as a result of the pandemic. And clearly that's going to have an impact on who is eligible as well.
Well, and that's a question, of course, but it does seem pretty obvious that the reason for people going on to food share is because of the economy, because people are losing their jobs or can't work right now.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. You know, we've just seen a very sharp increase, both in unemployment and as well as individuals who maybe still have retained employment, but, you know, have had their hours reduced or have seen their earnings impacted in another way that perhaps they're still working to some extent now. They're not totally unemployed, but, you know, their hours or their earnings might be curtailed in such a way that, you know, their income is low enough to qualify for food share where perhaps it did not, you know, before the onset of the pandemic. So, you know, we've seen both of those factors, I think, come into play that are causing people to become newly eligible for the income criteria for this program.
Yeah. Now, I think something that is important to clarify is that we're talking about food share benefits. We're not talking about the use of food pantries, which seems like it has also increased during this time. Is that right?
Well, we think so. We don't have hard data on that, but certainly it's fair to say there's been a lot of news reports to that extent, just anecdotally based on those news reports and other experts that we talked to in our research for this report. We're certainly hearing that food pantries in Wisconsin and nationally are really seeing a spike in demand. And, you know, that's kind of the other piece that sort of corroborates this broader trend of more people that are experiencing food scarcity, whether it be that they're looking to address that through trying to enroll in food share or going to a food pantry. to try to satisfy that demand.
Now, hopefully we're looking at a year from now that we'll be talking about the end of these exemptions, or we're looking at a year away from now when people might be pushed off of the program. But if, you know, this special dispensation just ends outright, what's the broader impact of the loss of more people on food share? Because we're not just talking about the people who are facing hunger. We're also talking about the businesses that rely on food share.
Well, and that's where it's just going to be really crucial to see what our economic recovery looks like over the next year. You know, we saw this initial massive spike in unemployment around April and May. We have been able to recover some of those jobs, but, you know, there's been a significant number that we have not recovered. And of course, the longer that some of those folks are out of work, the more likely it becomes that they would end up in a longer term unemployment situation. And so I don't think we can, you know, certainly I think there's reason to believe that we will be in a better position in a year, but, you know, we just don't know. We're going to have to kind of see how the economic recovery proceeds, because, you know, there certainly is a possibility that there are going to continue to be people that are going to be unemployed, you know, definitely in the coming months, certainly in the next 6 months and possibly beyond that.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Sommerhauser is a researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, which analyzed the use of Wisconsin's food share program in its recent report titled Rise in Food Share, Another Indicator of Pandemic's Toll. You can find more of our conversations with the forum at WUWM.com. We'll take a short break, then we'll go over some basics about how the government functions in the U.S., its foundation, and how it's evolved over time. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. As we mentally prepare ourselves for the vice presidential debate in the final weeks of the 2020 presidential campaign season, there has been an even greater focus on U.S. politics. But these conversations can become stilted by our own knowledge gaps about how government works in our country. We want to give people a better working knowledge of how our political system developed here in the U.S., how it's changed over time, and how it functions today. Phil Rocco is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University, and he joins me now to talk about U.S. government and politics. Phil, thank you so much for joining us once again here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, always good to be here, Joy.
I think like a lot of people, I'm somewhat versed in our political system, but there's a lot of things that end up being a little confusing. So how do we define the political system we have here in the United States?
When I think about the political system in the United States, I think about the fact that we have two major features that really make up our politics and define the way that our politics works. The first is federalism, or the fact that we have different levels of government whose powers are sort of in balance, sometimes in competition and sometimes collaborating with one another. And then we also have the separation of powers, or the fact that we have three separate branches of government at the federal level, a president, a legislative branch of the Congress, and an independent judiciary. And if you think about it, many of the main sort of conflicts, contentions arise out of those separations of power between levels and the separation of power between branches. It sets up a lot of the conflicts that we see. There's a misconception that there's some sort of difference between being a republic and a democracy. When in a conversation and somebody says that, I always have to point them back to the writings of the founders, in that the founders really didn't make much of a distinction between what we think of as a representative democracy. So we elect people to represent us. If we don't like them, we throw them out. They don't really make much of a distinction between that and a republic. That's sort of what a republic is. When they distinguish that from a democracy, small d, what they mean is that we're not, as all of the people in the polity, voting on every decision that comes before us. What they mean is that there are people who represent us. But the way that they do is fundamentally structured by these separations of power.
You just brought up, of course, the writings of the founders. And this is something that continually comes up today, the kinds of things that really regulate how our government is meant to function. When we talk about these things that define how our government works, what are we talking about? Is that the Constitution? Is that, you know, different laws and regulations? What are the kinds of things that really govern this system outside of the people elected to work in it?
I really think about there being five major sources of law in the United States. There's the old common law, which derives from the sort of British tradition, and that's displaced whenever we make law in another way. And those other ways include the Constitution, which really sets the parameters for most of what we think of happening in the American government. There's statutes. That's what Congress makes. That's what legislatures make. There's administrative rules or executive orders, and those are made by the executive branches of the federal and state governments, but those are made typically pursuant to, or they have to justify themselves with reference to legislation, right? They can't just necessarily do anything that they want. They're sort of circumscribed by legislation. And then there's what voters pass at the ballot box in states that allow that to happen. And that is law that derives from a vote and action of the people.
Yeah. So can you give us an example of how these different things interact, in the real world?
I think probably the most important example of this, and it's happening this year because it's 2020, is the census. And the census isn't just a statistical survey. It's the thing that defines how many members of Congress your state gets. It defines the way that states shape how many representatives an area of the state gets in redistricting. So it's really, really important. But it works through an interaction of these different elements of law. So in Article 1 of the Constitution, it requires there to be an actual enumeration of all persons residing in the United States every 10 years. It doesn't make a distinction between whether or not those people are citizens or not. It's all whole persons. Now, Congress has to make law to enact and supervise the implementation of that part of the Constitution. And so there's something called the Census Act. And in the Census Act, Congress is taking on its responsibility under Article 1 to every 10 years provide for a census. Now, back in the 19th century, Congress used to have to design the census every 10 years by committee. And there was no Census Bureau. They had to sort of hire people on the fly. It was a very messy, messy process. As we move to the 20th century, we have a Census Bureau. And so what Congress is doing in the Census Act is it's telling the Census Bureau how it is supposed to do its job, where it is supposed to enumerate people, when it's supposed to enumerate people, how the numbers have to be delivered, so that we can ultimately every 10 years make sure that the composition of Congress looks like the population, that places that have more population are getting more representation in the House of Representatives. Now, that is what Congress passes, right? The Census Act. Then the executive branch has to make rules that interpret what Congress means when it passes the Census Act. And that includes rules about where they're going to indicate people's place of residence. So for example, college students who are living on campus most of the year and are home with their parents in the summer, even though their parents might claim them as a dependent, for example, for tax purposes, they're still going to be enumerated at their college. That's something that emerges from the residence rules from the Census Bureau. And when there is, you know, conflict about what the executive branch is doing on the census, challenged to its interpretation of the Census Act or the Constitution, then things move typically to litigation in the courts. And so you can see just one piece of the Constitution, the census, but many different sources of law that go into how it works every 10 years.
So the idea is ultimately that no branch of government should really be working by itself, that they all are different cogs in the same machine.
Yes. And I think that sometimes in civics class in school, people are familiar with a triangle that shows different branches of government that have different checks and balances on one another. And the idea is that, you know, Congress does the legislating and the executive branch does the enforcement and the judicial branch does the sort of mediation, right, defining what the law is. But that's actually, you know, I think misrepresents to some extent the fact that these are separated branches of government that share power with one another, and that in fact that checks and balances system is not a sort of self-propelling machine. The idea in the writings of the founders was sort of borrowed from the sort of physical sciences of the day, that there would be some sort of counterbalance because each institution would defend its own prerogatives, sort of jealously guard those own prerogatives. Ambition made to counteract ambition, I think, is the phrase from Madison. But, you know, in reality, the founders didn't necessarily envision there being nationalized political parties of the sort that we have presently. In some instances, there are really strong incentives for the legislative branch to give the executive branch, vest it with a lot of power, and create an ability for the executive branch to make that checking and balancing of the legislative particularly difficult.
You know, you mentioned the party system here in the United States. How did they imagine parties would work in the United States? And why has it developed differently?
Well, I think the founders were not naive to the fact that when people engage in any kind of political action, that they're going to form groups. There's sometimes this misunderstanding that the founders, you know, they didn't imagine that parties could possibly, you know, exist. But that's not quite true. In the sense that they did know that people would form sort of around collective interests in some way. This was already present at the moment that the Constitution was struck, because you had, for example, a merchant class, you had plantation owners, you had slave owners, you had non-slave owners, you had different sort of economic sections of the country, that the Constitution is really the product of them warring with one another over their own interests, right? It's a sort of composite picture of those interests. So they were really aware of that. I think what they didn't possibly imagine was that you would have mass political parties with sort of symbols and labels and a lot of participation in those, sort of stretching across different levels of government. And I think that that is something that really quickly developed, obviously, after the founding. But it's not something that I think the founders were necessarily thinking of when they were thinking of the way that government would be composed.
Well, now when we look at the three branches of government at the federal level, I think what you're saying is we've seen this play out with the Senate, with the House in some situations, giving power to the executive branch in a way that doesn't really fit with how we viewed these different branches working initially.
I mean, if you think about the two sort of twin problems that I think really contributed to defining the founding, is one is, you know, obviously a real concern about tyranny in the form of the tyranny of a crown. There was no model for what an executive looked like, a president, other than something that looked like a king. So there's a lot of concerns about that. But then there's also the concern about the Articles of Confederation, which preceded the founding, which were really a system of government that gave very little ability to the government to coordinate its action, to coordinate the production of currency, to coordinate the production of national defense or raising an army to defend its territory. Those are really sort of the two sort of twin conflicts that are propelling the design of the Constitution. But the emergence of a national economy, the emergence of sort of industrial capitalism, brings with it some greater demand, wherever that demand might emerge from, whether from the capitalist class or from workers for defenses against the Industrial Revolution. But it creates a demand for an executive branch to administer a greater scope of both the economy, but also international relations. So you get this sort of rise of executive branches really internationally. And that creates challenges for actually maintaining some of the logic, the Madisonian logic of the system. So I'll give you one example, which is that following the Second World War. We saw the real increase in the number of federal agencies between the war and the New Deal. And there are real questions about how are we going to make sure that these agencies are acting within the scope of the laws that Congress passed. And so one of the things that Congress does in the mid-1940s is it passes something called the Administrative Procedure Act, which gives some guidelines and some pretty prescriptive rules that the executive branch has to follow when it makes its own administrative rules. It has to allow for a comment period. It has to publish the rules before it puts them into place. It has to make rules that have some clear bearing from the law. And its rulemaking decisions are subject to, in most cases, judicial review. So what Congress has to do at that point is sort of use the power of statutes to reinscribe its checks and balances sort of role in the constitutional system after the executive branch increases. But this doesn't always happen. One example I like to think about here is that, you know, as the executive branch is sort of gaining sort of leverage over the course of the latter half of the 20th century, Congress does not always expand its own capacities in response to that. And, you know, in the 1990s, Congress actually divests itself of a lot of key institutions that help it challenge and sort of exert its authority over the executive branch. It eliminates what was called the Office of Technology Assessment, which provided assessments of technological decisions made by the executive branch. It drastically reduces funding for the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, and it eliminates something called the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations, which was the sort of only place where actors from multiple levels of government could sort of formally meet with one another and talk about the effects of federal decisions on state and local governments. So Congress really divests itself a lot of those capacities. And I think the impact of that is, on the one hand, the executive branch gains a lot of power over the legislature. But at the same time, I think you see this is a kind of windfall for lobbying organizations who step in to provide some of the expertise that Congress has divested itself of.
So what we're seeing now is we have a president who has said, you know, the Constitution gives him the right to do anything he wants. We've had a Congress that, as you mentioned, has divested itself from expanding its own powers. It feels like the systems aren't balancing one another the way that they necessarily were meant to. Where do we go from here?
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point, is you have this confusion about, you know, what is the appropriate role of the executive branch? And if Congress isn't able to check the branch, sort of what do we do about that? And I think that there are sort of two sets of reform proposals that are out there. On the one hand, there are political scientists like Will Howell and Terry Moe at University of Chicago and Stanford, respectively, whose position is the executive branch is sort of growing, and rather than try to resist that growth, what we need to do is provide a framework to make sure that it's playing a legitimate role. So they sort of argue for formalizing some of those expanded powers, right? Giving the president the ability to make sort of take it or leave it type decisions that Congress has to, you know, vote up or down within a certain number of days. There's another approach, and I would say a, you know, maybe more Madisonian approach, which is to say, before we, you know, just sort of assume that the growth of the executive branch is ineluctable, that we need to really give Congress powers that it has not been able to exercise. And, you know, we need to make sure that there are adequate staffs, that committees are able to meet, that we have regular order, that people are sort of spending a certain number of days in session and doing oversight of the executive branch, and that Congress has the analytical capacities that it needs to check the executive branch.
Yeah. Well, Phil, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Yeah, my pleasure, Joy.
Phil Rocco is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. You can hear our previous conversations with him at wuwm.com. After the break, we'll learn about Milwaukee's Black Knight Brawl. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. October is LGBT History Month, a time to celebrate the progress made and reflect on the activists who've made getting here possible. The Stonewall riots in New York's Greenwich Village kicked off the modern pride movement. But 8 years before that, the patrons of an unassuming gay bar in a Milwaukee neighborhood that no longer exists took a stand against intolerance and disrespect. Historian Michael Takash spoke to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in June of last year about the event known as the Black Knight Brawl.
After World War II, Milwaukee was fortunate enough to have spaces where LGBTQ people could gather and really start forming not what I'd call a community, but maybe the beginnings or the roots of a community. And one of these spaces was the 400 block of North Plankinton Avenue, which is now, as you know, a freeway off-ramp. So at that time, from 1949 until 1961, LGBT bars began opening in this block, mainly because the buildings were somewhat abandoned. The area was obviously marked for freeway construction, and there was really not a lot of interest in maintaining these buildings if they were just going to be torn down. So obviously they were a perfect place for people who didn't want to be found except by those that they wanted to invite. And by August of 1961, there were actually four LGBT bars operating on this block, starting with the Riviera, which is the oldest, which had opened in fall of 1949, the Fox Bar, which opened in December of 1949, the Crystal Palace, which was just across the river in the 400 block of North Water Street, and then, of course, the Black Knight, which was at 400 North Plankinton Avenue. And the Black Knight actually had a long history before it was known as the Black Knight. It was originally known as the Old Mill Inn and was known as a sailor bar, which was essentially a men-only bar that was available for river and harbor workers to kind of gather in a bit of a rough place after hours. The other thing about the sailor bars was that they were often frequented by people who were looking for other sailors, which is kind of humorous when you think about it. That this man-only space could exist and that it was welcoming to people who really had nowhere else to go. At the time, these were really kind of outlaw places. It was illegal to serve homosexuals liquor in Wisconsin. It was illegal to allow them to congregate on your premises, and it could cost bar owners their licenses and bartenders their reputation. People could be fired for serving gay people in bars at the time. So in 1959, the Old Mill Inn closed, and a gentleman who was a bit of a financier and a bit of a whiz kid with money in Milwaukee saw an opportunity to open the city's first gay bar, which was really a gay bar that was known. It was above the line. It was not secret. It was not underground. It was really advertising and publicizing. Another business owner had attempted this earlier, about a year earlier, and had failed. But they were really willing to make a chance with what became known as Mary's Tavern. And Mary's Tavern was only open for a short time. Mary, who was brought in from Oklahoma to manage and own the bar because the financier could not get a liquor license for various reasons, Mary came in and was a bit offended by what she saw and what she was promised, and essentially said that the homosexuals had run off all of her good customers. They were terrorizing her, and she could have danced in the streets when she found out the bar would be closing. So in 1961, this address, 400 North Plankinton, which had a long history by that time, opened up again as the Black Knight. And it's a curious story because a Kohl's food store butcher retired from his job and took over this business. And, I mean, he was a family man, he had children, he had been married several times. And it was a curious choice for him because he was opening a bar that was not only, once again, tolerating gay people, but inviting, welcoming, and celebrating them. So the Black Knight throughout 1961 became a bit of a famous place because it wasn't a straight bar that allowed people of LGBT origin into the building. It was a LGBT bar that might allow straight people into the building. And this was something new for Milwaukee. But what was most interesting about this story is what happened on August 4th, 1961. On that night, there were four servicemen from Great Lakes Naval Academy who had been partying at a Brady Street bar and were really kind of wound up. And the bartender at that bar gave them a dare and said, you know, I bet you a certain number of dollars that you won't go down to this bar on Plankinton Avenue. And the guys were like, well, why wouldn't we go down there? And he's like, you'll find out when you get there. So the guys came down to the Black Knight and upon arrival found out that it was a gay bar and were not exactly thrilled. They felt that they'd been kind of had by the dare. And when the bouncer asked them for ID, they refused to give it. When he asked them to sign a letter saying that they knew they were in a gay bar, they refused to sign it. This was a common practice at the time, so people couldn't say that they had been, you know, conned or robbed or scammed by the bar owner. So the bartender tried to kick them out, and once they got out on the patio on the sidewalk on the corner of St. Paul and Plankinton, all four men started jumping the bouncer. And this was early in the night, so their bar wasn't busy. It was essentially the bartender, the bouncer, and the bouncer's girlfriend, who was Josie Carter.
Josie is another key character in addition to the bar owner, Wally Weatham. So tell us a little bit about Josie before we get into the events that transpired after the servicemen were attacking the bouncer.
Sure. So I have to say, I mean, Josie was one of the most remarkable people I've met in the entire time I've been researching LGBT history in Wisconsin. Josie lived her life really socially as a gender nonconforming person of color at a time when this was unthinkable in Milwaukee. I mean, police officers could stop you if they suspected you were cross-dressing. They could inspect your genitals. They could force you to change your clothes. They could remove your clothes. They could do all sorts of horrible things. And somehow Josie persevered over all of this. She had great relationships with police officers. She commented on it frequently that she didn't have any trouble with the police unless she started trouble. She really was what we might call today a bit of a scenester. I mean, she and her friend Jamie Gaze, also a drag queen of the time, really set the scene in Milwaukee. I mean, someone who I interviewed recently said, you know, they weren't just part of a scene, they were the scene. Where they went, they made things happen. They made bars popular. They made people come, and they really paved the way for people to come out and go places and have fun. And that was really Josie's life. I mean, she was a person of leisure, and she was a hostess with the mostest. And it's just really amazing that, you know, when we met with her in 2011, she had really, you know, not a whole lot to say about this incident, which was pretty significant from a historical perspective. The story lead she gave us upon further research was of much greater magnitude than I think she ever even understood or expected. So on that night, on August 4th, 1961, it was one of those humid, foggy, gray August nights. Those servicemen left the bar in a huff, and they obviously were disgruntled. They were asked to leave the bar by the bouncer. They jumped the bouncer and started beating on him, and these are four Naval Academy recruits versus one single man who's unarmed. And the minute this happened, Josie said, you know, she stood up and she wasn't quite ready. Apparently, she was not fully dressed for the evening. She'd been kind of hanging out and sipping a cocktail and relaxing. But she grabbed two beer bottles and she went outside. And her exact words were, oh, no, you're not going to beat up my man. And so she headed outside and, as she said, gave them everything she had in those bottles. And she took two of the guys out. So the remaining servicemen were amazed. I mean, they were stunned. They had literally been KO'd by a woman who, you know, they at that time did not even know was a drag queen, per se. So they left the premises. They went back to Brady Street. They went back to the bar. They said, pay up. We went to the bar. We got beat up. This is ridiculous. And as the guys continued drinking and the bartender was stoking the fires of their fury, they decided that they were going to round up some guys and go down and clean up the Black Knight for putting their friends in the hospital. And this was probably the dumbest decision these four guys have ever made in their life. And I would love to meet with them and hear their take on the story, if I could locate them. But whereas they encountered a bar that had just opened, it was barely busy. There were only three people in it when they first arrived. When they came back, there were 70-some people in the bar. The bar was at full capacity. And all of those people in the bar had been listening to Josie talk about these ruffians who came in, beat up her husband, and caused trouble. So when they opened the door, they thought that they were in for an easy fight. But they opened the door and said something along the lines of, "Come on, you sick f-." And every single person in the bar looked at them, and that was it. It was down. The music stopped, and the battle was on. And what's really interesting about this is that, you know, this isn't just a matter of people fighting back against violence. It was a matter of people fighting back against their turf being invaded, disrespected, and vandalized. This was their space, and they had fought long and hard to get it. There were other bars in town that had gone back, you know, a long time, but none of them were really lasting. None of them were really owned by the LGBT community. They were always owned by straight people who were trying to make money off the LGBT community, or straight bar owners who would, you know, collect money from the LGBT community but never actually admit it. So this was a bit of a turn in Milwaukee. This was a bit of a change in tone. And as the battle went on and the bar was literally leveled, I mean, everything inside was destroyed, every bar stool, every bottle of liquor, the jukebox, the player piano, all windows. People were actually thrown through the windows. And in the end, the police came down and took everyone off in a paddy wagon. But none of the patrons of the Black Knight were charged or arrested for any reason. In fact, the police came down and told Josie, "These people have no business harassing you, and we will take care of this for you."
Which and that is, seems like a pretty standout relationship and, you know, a unique police and community relations in a time where there's legal action you can take for serving homosexuals in a bar, for, you know, open cross-dressing on the street, for a police community to have a good relationship with Josie and the people of that bar. It seems like a really pinnacle moment and, you know, solidification of their place.
Absolutely. And I marveled at this story and thought this can't possibly be the way it went down, but it is exactly the way it went down. And finding, you know, newspaper documentation, finding firsthand reports of people who were there and just piecing together this greater story, it was really remarkable to stumble upon what is not only the first LGBT uprising in Wisconsin history, but one that occurred 8 years before the Stonewall Uprising, at a time where around the country these little uprisings were happening, but they received next to no media attention and next to no historical significance because no one was piecing together what was happening. These things happen in isolation and pockets, and unlike the Stonewall riots, there were not significant communities of writers who were LGBT-minded or even radical or revolutionary-minded in Milwaukee at the time. So the fact that this made the media and what happened next is even more significant. But the fact that, you know, the police were on the side of the LGBT community at a time where there was not much of a community is, like you said, unprecedented.
Right. And was there legal action taken against the servicemen who started the fight? You mentioned they were taken away, but was there any further legal repercussions for them?
There were and there weren't. So the servicemen were charged with a number of things, and the charges were listed in the paper. Their names and addresses were listed in the paper. I mean, they were really seen as problems. They were really the villains of the story, and rightly so. Unfortunately, Judge Christ T. Serafim reversed the charges, saying there was not enough evidence that they had actually started the fight, which at the time was laughable and really remains laughable today.
Right. To come back to the scene of your first fight, that's pretty clear indication.
Yeah, exactly. And so in the end, they really got off with not much more than a lot of bumps and bruises. The Black Knight fared worse. Wally was under a lot of stress to change the bar's name, to shut the bar down, to change the patronage to straight. refused to do pretty much all of that until the Common Council made him, and he did change the name to Bourbon Beat, which had operated under until 1966. At that time, the neighborhood was really in peril because 794 was heading towards it, and St. Paul Avenue was actually extended over the river. At the time of the Black Knight Brawl, this was a dead end. So the bar was literally sitting at a dead end at the river where St. Paul now extends. So it was kind of in the way, and eventually it was torn down. But I think that, you know, the legacy of the Black Knight Brawl, there's so many layers to this. One, again, this is a historic uprising. This is something that wouldn't have happened had there not been a dedicated space that people felt that they owned and needed to defend. Number two, the fact that there was a sizable LGBT community large enough to have their own spaces and large enough to fight back when those spaces were endangered shocked Milwaukee like nothing else. I mean, people who were around at the time said it was the first time they had ever heard of gay people in Milwaukee. It was the first time they'd ever heard of violent gay people. The idea was that, you know, LGBT people were sick. I mean, they were psychologically unwell and that, you know, they needed to be fixed through behavior modification and conversion therapy. And the idea that gay people could rise up together and fight back against bullies was shocking to people in Milwaukee in 1961. And it sparked a couple of chain reactions. One, in early 1960s, there was a bit of a gay panic in Milwaukee. The media really fed this fire, saying that, you know, there were uncountable numbers of homosexuals lurking in Milwaukee, and they were under the surface, and at any moment they would strike, and they were, you know, predatory, and they were law-breaking, and there was just so much negativity around this. But what that did, by talking about the existence of gay people and the places where gay people were known to go, was that really the media was creating a blueprint and a roadmap for closeted gay people who thought they were the only ones in the whole world. People like Eldon Murray, who were founders of later LGBT organizations, commented that until the Black Knight Brawl and this media panic that followed, they literally thought there were no other gay people in the world, much less Milwaukee. And when these articles started coming out talking about homosexuality and talking about gay places and the fact that there was this gay underworld, it fascinated them to know that there was someone like them in the world, that they were reflected in this space. So really, really powerful in driving a sense of community in Milwaukee that really, you know, built up over time and continues to flourish today. It really could be said that the Black Knight Brawl, in many ways, is the birthplace of LGBT pride in Milwaukee, because before that, I mean, people were laying down and taking the abuse, and the Black Knight Brawl was the first time people fought back and said, no, I'm done with this. You will respect me and my places and my community. The other thing that happened was that gay panic led to some urban renewal choices, shall we say. Again, the freeway was routed directly through this neighborhood. It was routed through another neighborhood on the north side where the Park East Freeway once stood, where there were a number of LGBT landmarks after World War II. Really, the entire neighborhood as it stood, as it was known, as it was exposed by the brawl and the subsequent media panic, was erased by 1966. That whole area was gone. And, I mean, much like other marginalized groups suffered under freeway construction, the LGBT community was really scattered to the wind. And it wasn't until 1968 when businesses started to congregate around First and Pittsburgh and Walker's Point, establishing Walker's Point really as the next big LGBT neighborhood, and that legacy continues today. But if it wasn't for this brawl, the media exposure that there was an LGBT community, the urban renewal choices that were made, and of course the congregation of businesses in Walker's Point, we'd be in a very different Milwaukee today if not for this incident. And you really have to hand it to someone like Josie Carter, who, I mean, was living in a time of great marginalization.
Absolutely. Well, Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and share the story of the Night Brawl. I could listen to hours more of all the little intricacies of this story. But thank you for sharing it with us, and thank you for all of your work.
Okay, thanks so much.
Michael Takash is the curator of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project and the author of LGBT Milwaukee. He spoke to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in June of 2019. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.